You're listening to the Tupton Children Podcast.
And so here I am again meeting them in a new circumstance. And at one time they're strangers, and at one time they're somebody familiar. But in any case, I've already dedicated my life to their benefit by taking the Bodhisattva vow. And so reminding myself of that when I meet all these new people, it helps bring forth that very expanded mind that is interested in, cares for the welfare of others, no matter whether we know them or don't know them, like them or don't like them. And it helps to quiet down the mind that forms so many opinions about people just by looking at them. Because it's looking at people from a totally different perspective. The way that a bodhisattva or a bodhisattva wannabe trains their mind. And so this can, especially in the summertime when there's lots of insects around, spread to the insects that we encounter when we fly over the ocean, thinking of all the different creatures in the ocean who we'll never see and can easily forget about. And yet these are also sentient beings with potential to become fully awakened Buddhas. So when we think about that, then we know we can't just forget about those beings. That every single living being is important to us because depending on them, we generate bodhicitta, and depending on them, we practice the six perfections. And depending on them, we can attain full awakening. So there's this very deep and important connection that we have with each and every living being from the past that we need to cultivate and deepen as much as we can now and in the future. And to do that so that we have the inspiration and aspiration and energy to progress on the path to full awakening for their benefit, chiefly by understanding and then realizing emptiness and using that realization to cleanse our mind completely of all defilements and their latencies. So with that kind of perspective, let's dive into Nagarjuna's teachings on the precious garland and especially on the Bodhisattva practice.
Thank you.
So have you been trying to do something about them? Or did you just take your notebook and put it on the shelf saying, well, we won't have teachings on this for a while, so I don't need to look at my notebook? No, what?
I looked at them. I'm kind of embarrassed to say that I have a lot more of those faults than I thought I did. Variations on the theme, you know, as far as pride and haughtiness. Concealment came up. Inattention. Lack of mindfulness, spacing out. Yeah, more than I want to admit.
Yeah. Okay, so when you do look at them, then you find you have more of them than you would like to admit that you have, or that you wish you had. But at the same time, that gives you the basis upon which to do something about them. Yeah, because if you don't look at your notes, then you really have more of them than you think you did, because you didn't even, you definitely have the one of, you know, not paying attention to teachings and not taking the Dharma to heart. So how many of you looked at your notes?
I've looked at or studied a few different things.
Let's start with looked at. How many studied?
I meditated on them.
Okay, one person.
I went through them. I meditated on a few of them, the first 10.
Okay. I would say our emphasis has very strongly been on doing the rhythms, on the forces. So that's just, yeah.
So there's a reason.
There's a reason, but
called an excuse.
Called an excuse. But I had
a good time practicing number 44.
On number 44?
44, yeah.
Which one was that?
Conceptuality and connection with gratitude.
Yeah. So conceptuality. Yeah.
I didn't study, but I practiced it.
Oh, you practiced doing it. Oh, I see. Not opposing it. But at least you realized that you're doing it.
Yeah, I had a name.
Ah, you had a name for it, okay. And that helped you realize and acknowledge what has been going on in your mind for a long time that you hadn't been able to identify before. Good. So, does it make sense for me to teach this evening?
Yes, it does. I need you to do that.
The commitment
Why?
To study these during retreat is also there. To chart them and to do the detail of looking at them.
So in the last 6 weeks you haven't done anything.
Oh, so long was that?
And you're saving it all for retreat. So I'm expecting more out of you, you know, in terms of this. So I'll teach this week, and then next week we'll see what happens. Maybe I'll ask you at the beginning of next week, and if people haven't looked at things, then maybe it's better to have a study session next week. Without me.
But one of the ones that did come up for me a lot in the past year is the pride of inferiority. I've been working a lot with my struggle around my capacity to understand all the teachings on emptiness. Mm-hmm. And I generally don't have... I came up with a lot of, it wasn't a healthy kind of regret, because I realized that the first few years here at the Abbey I was doing anything but studying. And then when I decided to finally make an effort at studying, then I came up with kind of a discouragement and a remorse about all the years that I had wasted not trying. And then I came up with the idea that because of that, my capacity, now I'm doubting my capacity and I'm struggling around my sense of my self-doubt. I generally don't have self-doubt when it comes to some of the teachings, but all the emptiness teachings this summer have been so amazing, but I've felt overwhelmed by how much I haven't been able to garner in my mind. And so I've come up with a lot of self-doubt, and then I've got this part that says, well, I'm not as good as I thought, and then I started tumbling into a pride that was really kind of putting me in a place that said I wasn't capable.
So discouragement.
Discouragement, but in a deeper way that I have had before, and it's been really hard to process.
And are you able to see how that isn't just one isolated incident, but how this met this particular fault of one of the 57 plays out repeatedly in your life? I mean, in the sense of identifying, this is a fault that I've had for many years that I haven't recognized as a fault and have just completely succumbed to.
I have seen that, and I actually thought that I had been able to work on it to where I was having a lot more inspiration, a lot more curiosity, a lot more interest. But I think with the emptiness teachings this year, I just found myself putting my expectations a lot higher than what I needed to. And then I've used the discouragement now to pull away from doing any. I'm paralyzed.
So what are you going to do about it?
Well, what I did is I took a week off in Shanti Cabin, mm-hmm. and I did a retreat on Manjushri, and I took Kenzer Jump and Tech Chunk's book with me, and I just, I don't want to say chewed, but I took a few of his chapters and I sat with them and I read them over and over again. Mm-hmm. And so I think Manjushri, you know, I think that was really helpful because it's been really dry, like chewing on bones for the past few months, and I wanted to juice it up a little bit. But to see how the discouragement, that this whole idea that you think you've got a handle on an affliction because your mind seems lighter, more intrigued, more curious, but it's right there all the time. And when you set up an unrealistic expectation about where you think you should be, that laziness, for me, is a particular way in which I tailspin, because I set really high expectations. Misunderstanding my curiosity and my interest as something above where I am. It inflates my ability, and then I tailspin into discouragement.
So a whole lot of
conceptualization. Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of judgment, self-judgment.
Yeah. So, when we get into that, our mind is completely stuck in the mental chatter of all this conceptualization. Yeah, it's like we're not here.
Yeah.
We're somewhere. We always say, oh, it's a person who's stuck in their head, don't we? Yeah, because we get stuck just in our own thoughts going round and around. Can't look at anything else, can't see anybody else, can't relate to anything except blah, 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 I'm inferior, I'm blah, 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 I, me, me, me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And underneath the whole thing is just Semke being absolute.
We have a microphone so that the audience can hear and the people online.
Yeah. Also, we're not making this into a therapy session.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to show how affliction took over my mind for the past few weeks.
Yeah.
But just to say that underneath all of this is just a very simple acceptance of saying I'm absolutely fine where I am, where I took off on this, I have no idea, but I'm doing just fine. My capacity is fine, my study is fine, I'm fine. But I needed to let go of all of the the judgment because I had another ballistic expectation where I thought it was supposed to come.
That you were able to come back.
Yeah.
After your mind went wandering and circles and
swirls. I hadn't done it for a while, you know, I guess I was getting a little nostalgic.
And then finally, after all of that, you...
I'm back to, I'm just fine. Proliferation, I think you call it.
Yes.
Numb-tongue.
Yeah, lots of numb-tongue. Yeah.
What I did was, I think the ones that I was feeling.
And that you were?
I was feeling.
Feeling.
And then I used the MBC language that we were working on. Mm-hmm. So I had a lot of wrath. So I took wrath and then I was like, okay, so what's the feeling behind it and what's the needs? And then to try and get a sense of it, you know, in my own language. Mm-hmm. So I could do like 57, but like the ones that, you know, like the number 44, you know, the kind of, the things that I was experiencing.
Yeah.
And just trying to make sense of them in a different way.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that helped me.
Yeah, yeah, that is going to help. Yeah, by identifying, by recognizing something you're doing, and then you use the NVC language to help you go deeper to really understand it. And in that way, you begin to remedy it, and instead of getting stuck in it, you're able to pull yourself out.
Yeah, it was a lot of fear, like when I go, like the raft led to fear.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting behind anger to find the fear, isn't it?
One of the ways that I've been using them is noticing how they ethically kind of add on, like for instance, I might be feeling some jealousy, and then what happens is my mind becomes really miserly because I can't rejoice at what someone else's good qualities. And then I flip over to the inferiority, because why can't I do this? So I'm not so good. So then all these things would just keep adding up. So the way I've been using this to do that, and then to think about past incidences and trying to figure out what was like the primary affliction or something, and then what are all the other ones that added onto it. So what I've been able to do is try to watch my mind when something's arising so I can stop it from going into the other ones, so that's how it means.
Yeah. Okay, so you've been able to look at how you start with one, and then it creates a whole web out of that. Yeah. And so to stop spinning the web so much. Okay. So the section we're entering into now, you know, we're on the last chapter, which is about the Bodhisattva practices. And so Nagarjuna began that with talking about these 57 faults so that we would know things that we need to work on, because if we're going to progress on the Bodhisattva path, we have to, you know, clean up our mind. So it's kind of like if you want to have a party and decorate the room, first you have to clean it before you add the decorations. So, same with our mind, we have to clean it from these 57. And so then the chapter that comes next is about the six perfections and compassion. And so first he talks about them, what he calls in a temporal way, in other words, how we practice them while we're on the path, when we're still ordinary beings. And then he talks about how we do the six perfections on the Bodhisattva ground. And then he talks about the qualities of a Buddha. So kind of leading us gradually, starting with how we are now, then on the Bodhisattva ground, and then at Buddhahood. Okay. So, I think the idea is that once we have calmed those 57, then we're in a much better place to cultivate the good qualities, which he's now going to describe. And although the good qualities are numerous and limitless, they're getting subsumed into the six perfections. Okay. So we're on 434. A bodhisattva should forsake these faults. One with monastic precepts must forsake even more. Since when one is freed of these faults, one can easily develop positive qualities. Okay, so the idea is that the more we free ourselves from the 57 defects, the easier it's going to be to cultivate the good qualities. And the more the 57 are there, the more we're going to be spending a lot of time going round and around in our mind with all this kind of conceptualization, and that conceptualization really prevents us from doing anything useful in terms of our Dharma practice. Have you noticed sometimes how much time you spend going around in your head just about this and that, thinking, what does this person think of me? What does that person think of me? Did I do this right? Did I do that wrong? What is this person doing? Why are they doing it that way? What does this all mean for me? Should I go here? Should I go there? What should I decide to do anyway? Or maybe I should do this other thing. Yeah? A lot of time just spinning, isn't it? Yeah? And not really doing very much with our mind. And we can even spend that time spinning in the Dharma. Yeah. That's when we think we're practicing. Let's see, I want to do a retreat on this. Shall I do the retreat here? Shall I do the retreat there? Maybe not that retreat. Maybe I should do this retreat instead. But before I do the retreat, I want to read this book and I want to study that book. But I haven't gotten around to reading these books because I'm doing all these other things, and maybe how am I going to do work my time schedule so that I can read these books and then get that all done before I do the retreat? But which books do I want to read before which retreat, and where am I going to do the retreat, and how am I going to get food when I do the retreat? And yeah, the same mechanism, just the content is Dharma. And people often can spend an entire retreat thinking about all the Dharma practice they're going to do after retreat is over. Yeah? I'll go here for teachings, I'll go there for teachings. And then meanwhile, day by day, the retreat time is over. Yeah? And our mind's just spinning. When I was in India, one of the things I did, I had the opportunity to give a talk to a group of teenagers at Pema Sal, which is a hostel that's right next to the central Tibetan school in Mungo. And it was very interesting, you know, what came... no, actually, it wasn't that talk, I'm sorry. It was the talk that I gave in Singapore the day we arrived, and it was to the Buddhist Youth Network, so it was all young people who came. And they, all their questions centered around the basic problem was, what do other people think about me? Yeah? And all the questions were variations on how do I, you know, how do I live my life so that other people think well of me? Okay. And, and I was talking to them, and I knew very well what they were talking about because I spent years as a teenager and young adult spinning around in this way in one way or another. I see a few other nodding heads of, you know, do I fit in? Do I belong? I don't know if I belong, if I fit in. Do these people accept me? Don't they accept me? You know, do they like me? Do I like them? What's going on? You know, what does this friend mean when they said that? What did that person mean when they said this? You know, and it was just amazing. One question after another, all centered on that. And just, you know, seeing how, of course, at different stages in our life, we have different things that we center all this conceptualization on. And, you know, you might center it on what other people think of me when you're a teenager and young adult, but then as you grow older, you bring a different version of that with you, but still keep ruminating about it. And so just to think of, you know, how much time we spend basically just spinning and not doing anything useful with our time. And, you know, and then at the end of the day is over. And sometimes you sit down to do something. You're offering service and you sit down to do something. And then you pause and your mind goes, you know, all over the place about this, that, and the other thing for who knows how long, and then you kind of get back to what you were doing before. Yeah. And so, you know, here I'm just commenting on the amount of time this kind of conceptualization consumes in our life. Not to mention how much it pollutes our mind with all sorts of wrong ideas. Yeah, because we're basically thinking incorrectly. And so we're just getting stuck in more and more wrong ideas that, you know, we think are not wrong ideas, but are actually very important. Okay? So it takes some time to really notice what we're doing, and then to examine these thoughts and ask ourselves, are these thoughts, first of all, are they realistic? And second of all, are they beneficial? Do they have much to do with reality or not? Yeah. And if they aren't realistic and they aren't beneficial, then how can we loosen our fascination with them? Yeah, because the fascination is all self-centeredness, isn't it? Yeah, because we're all thinking about ourselves. And that's why I like in retreats, you know, having everybody write their problem down and then put it in the bowl in the middle, and you have to pick up another problem and ruminate on that all retreat is whenever you start to ruminate on your own stuff. Yeah? And it gets really boring thinking about somebody else's problem. You know? But our own thing that we're captivated and fascinated with is so interesting. Yeah. But chances are the other person's problem is just another rendition of our own stuff. But we find it boring because it's not ours. It's not about us. It's about them. Yeah. So interesting. We get that. You know, your assignment is to ruminate on their problem, and you do it for, you know, 10 minutes, and then, this is boring. Why doesn't this person just get it together and drop this thing and get on with their life already? Yeah. But our problem, you know, around and around and around and around, and arising from this angle, that angle, here, there, everywhere, and yeah. And then our life goes by. Okay, so that's why he taught the 57 first, so that we can, hopefully begin to work our way through these and drop them, and then begin to pay attention to cultivating the virtuous qualities. Okay. So, what are the virtuous qualities that we should develop there in the next verse, 435? In short, the good qualities that a bodhisattva should develop are generosity, ethical conduct, fortitude, joyous effort, meditative stability, wisdom, compassion, and so on. Okay. So these, the and so on indicates that there's many more bodhisattva practices, but they're being condensed here into the six. So these six practices are also done by hearers and solitary realizers, but they aren't the perfections when these people do them, okay? Because to have any of these practices like generosity or ethical conduct, fortitude, joyous effort, meditative stability and wisdom, for them to be the perfections, the bodhisattva's perfections, we need three criteria, okay? So the first criteria is that we do them motivated by bodhicitta. The second criteria is that we think, we regard them with wisdom, seeing how the agent, object, and action exist dependently but lack inherent existence. And third, we dedicate the virtue from doing these practices to the awakening of ourself and all living beings. Okay? And so in this way, then these practices really transcend when they're just done ordinarily. Because, for example, generosity, I mean, lots of people are generous in the world, aren't they? Yeah, and people are constantly giving gifts to others and sharing their belongings and doing different kind things to others. So generosity is practiced a lot in the world, and it's admired by all the different religious traditions. But that doesn't make it the perfection of generosity, because the worst case is we're being generous to manipulate somebody to get them to like us. Okay? So then it's like, But even if we're not doing that, we're being generous, but maybe our thought still is somehow thinking about ourselves or thinking about the temporal good result that will come from our generosity. We'll feel better and other people will like us and this kind of thing. I was reading one article today about how some people are generous because it just gives them a buzz that makes them feel good about themselves. Yeah. And so a lot of people give this bit and that bit, and, offerings here and there. And the main thing is kind of to feel good. So, it's certainly better than being stingy, of course, And there is some element of caring for others in it. But there's also some ego perk in it as well. So, and we're going to suffer from that too. Yeah. But, like I said, it's much better than being miserly and stingy. But to constantly work at purifying our motivation, and gradually transforming it into the, the bodhicitta and doing this as something that, you know, we're already thinking far ahead, you know, I'm passing the catch up to somebody, you know, so that I can become a Buddha for the benefit of sentient beings, you know, so really transforming even small things into bodhisattva practices by thinking about bodhicitta when we do them. Yeah. So that's one thing, to actually, you know, take that time to do that. Yeah. Like when we make offerings in the morning, do we just kind of take, you know, the offering and put it on the altar and then go about doing our thing? Or do we pause for a moment and think, you know, have a bodhicitta motivation and offer it, and then think about, you know, the fact that we, as the one who's giving the object that's being given, the recipient of the gift, the action of the gift, that all these things don't exist with their own inherent nature, because they exist dependent on each other. And if we do that, then that fulfills the second criterion. And then after that, do we just walk away and then go have our cup of tea? Or do we dedicate the merit? Yeah, either then or at the end of the meditation session that we do after we make offerings, you know, to dedicate the merit properly for the enlightenment of self and others. Okay? So these are things, I don't know about you, but I hear this a lot, but when I really look at how much I actually take the time to do them when I'm doing various actions throughout the day, that's a whole other ballgame. Yeah. So, you know, hearing them a lot will have the effect, hopefully, of reminding us when something comes up to do these three parts, and thus transform whatever action we're doing to make it into one of the perfections. Or in our case, it's not actually, it's a similitude of the perfections, you know. Unless you're a bodhisattva, then it does become the real perfections. Okay, then, 3:36 and 4:36 and 4:37. Here he's identifying what the practices are, the six plus compassion. Okay, so generosity is to give up one's wealth. Ethical conduct is to endeavor to help others. Fortitude is the abandonment of anger. Joyous effort is enthusiasm for virtue. Meditative stability is unafflicted one-pointedness. Wisdom is definitively determining the truth's meaning. Compassion is a state of mind that savors only loving kindness for all sentient beings. Okay, so generosity is the intention to give, that is free of clinging attachment, okay? So it's the intention to give, and it's also the actions of giving. So it's both things. So here, I'll talk about that in a minute. Okay, so there's different types of generosity. Sometimes they say three, sometimes four. So generosity of material, yeah, generosity of love, generosity of
protection,
generosity of
dharma.
Okay. So here he's emphasizing the generosity of possessions. You know, because the line says giving away our wealth. Okay. So then there's this discussion about whether the karma of generosity is an intention, is it form? Is it a mental factor? What in the world is it? So you may have remembered when we were talking about karma in the Gongchen Longrim, we talked about intention karma and intended karma. So intention karma is the mental factor of intention. Okay? And if it's a virtuous action, like here, then that mental factor of intention and the primary consciousness that it's part of also are accompanied by another virtuous mental state. Okay? So, for example, non-attachment is one of the 11 virtuous mental states. So non-attachment is a balanced mind that likes to share, that likes to give. Okay? So you have the primary mind with different mental factors. Yeah. The mind that likes to give, the mind of non-attachment likes to give, is a virtuous mental factor. And by its being present, it makes the primary consciousness plus the five omnipresent mental factors that are with it, it makes that whole thing virtuous. And one of the five omnipresent ones is intention. Okay? So it's the mental factor of intention that's accompanied by another virtuous mental factor that becomes the virtuous karma. Okay? And the non-virtuous karma is a mental factor of intention that is accompanied by a non-virtuous mental factor. Okay? So that's the intention karma. And that's called mental karma. Yeah? So for the Satantrikas and the Chittamatrans, that's how they define karma. In other words, it's that mental intention. Okay? Intended karma, okay, for the Vaivasikas and the Prasangikas includes physical and verbal actions as well that are done motivated by that mental intention. It says also mental actions can be the intended karma. So those would probably be restraining from coveting, malice and wrong view, and then practicing the opposites of those things mentally. Okay? So the intended karma, okay, are the actions that are motivated by the intention karma.
Can I ask? Yeah. Did I hear correctly that the Chittamatrans and the Satrans, the action itself is not called karma?
Yeah, it's the intention.
It's just the intention. Thank you.
For the Satantrikas and Chittamatrans, it's the mental factor of intention that is karma. Okay? Okay, for the Vaivasikas and Prasangikas, it's the physical and verbal actions motivated by those. Okay? So there's some difference in the different schools here. Okay. I mean, in Chittamatrans, you can understand it because for them, everything's depending upon the latencies and creating the latencies. Okay.
It's very strange from the subject.
Okay. And then among the actions that are the intended karma, some are perceptible and some are imperceptible. So if you, when you take a precept, you receive an imperceptible form It's some kind of subtle form that is like a dam that protects you from doing those non-virtuous actions. And then, so that would be the imperceptible form. And then, because you can't see it with your eyes, okay, and then the perceptible form would be watching the body move or hearing the sound of the voice of the person, whatever they were doing, motivated by a virtuous or non-virtuous intention. Okay? Okay, then ethical conduct is usually defined as non-harmfulness and restraint from destructive behavior. But in the Bodhisattva practices, it refers to giving up striving and working only for our own benefit and our own purpose, and instead endeavoring to benefit others. So it's interesting that that's what ethical conduct means in terms of the Bodhisattva practice. Okay? It's, you know, giving up working for our own benefit. Yeah. Because that's the, you know, if you're doing a Bodhisattva practice and you've taken the Bodhisattva vow to benefit sentient beings, if you don't work for their benefit, then you're not keeping that the purpose of those ethical restraints. Okay. And so, you know, and instead what we want to do is to try and accomplish the welfare of others. Okay? And so this includes giving up the thought that is seeking only our own liberation and instead adopting the motivation to lead all living beings to liberation and full awakening. Okay? So this motivation that is the ethical conduct in the Bodhisattva practice is related to abandoning the 10 non-virtue, the 10 paths of non-virtue, which are the ordinary actions that are not necessarily we can abandon without them being the Bodhisattva's perfection. Are you getting what I mean? Okay, so somebody without the bodhicitta can abandon killing. When you take the 5 precepts, you abandon those actions. You don't necessarily have bodhicitta. Okay? So just the abandonment of the 10 non-virtues, yeah, is one form of virtue. But then abandoning them for the benefit of sentient beings and in order to accomplish the welfare of sentient beings and lead sentient beings to awakening is a different kind of motivation for doing the same thing of abandoning those 10. Are you getting what I mean? Okay, so those two motivations are fitting together, yeah, because when we do any of the 10 non-virtues, our motivation is working for ourself, and the result is damaging others. When we change our motivation, then, you know, our motivation, it benefits us, and it becomes a motivation that benefits others. Okay? So when you have that Bodhisattva intention, then it helps you to abandon the ten paths of non-virtue. And when you practice the 10 non-virtue, when you practice abandoning the 10 non-virtues with that understanding of what benefits you and what benefits others, that helps you in turn to generate the bodhicitta motivation. Getting what I'm saying? Okay. So, you know, for example, if I, you know, if I'm going to steal something, yeah, I could just say, okay, I'm not going to steal this because I'm going to go to a lower realm, and so abandon that. That's it. Okay? Or I could do, I could abandon that action of stealing by saying, the action of stealing harms me, but also harms the other person. Yeah, if I abandon it, it enables me to accomplish my own purpose by progressing along the path. And it enables me to accomplish the purpose of others, which is to be a benefit to them. And so therefore, with that kind of intention, I'm going to abandon stealing. Okay, so if you have that kind of mind, then that helps you generate that how ethical conduct is being defined here in terms of the bodhisattva practice. Okay, which is to abandon the negativities so that we stop harming others and to do actions that benefits them, including abandoning the wish for our own liberation and working for the liberation of all beings. Okay? And so this same way of thinking can be applied when you think of the bodhisattva and tantric ethical restraints. Okay? So that transgressing them is motivated by self-centeredness, and instead we want to keep these ethical restraints for the benefit of living beings. Okay? Yeah. So do you see how that motivation is a step up from the motivation that you have when you're simply practicing the Pratimoksha precepts? Yeah, which is often based on, I'm not going to do that because, I'm going to wind up in a lower realm. Okay, so it's a step up from that, enabling you to come again and again to the bodhicitta thought. Okay, so to protect us from non-virtue, which is the essence of the practice of ethical conduct, the Buddha talked about binding the senses. Okay, so what binding the senses means is being very mindful of what we want to pay attention to and what we don't want to pay attention to. And then having strong introspective awareness, which monitors our mind and sees and checks up what are we paying attention to and what aren't we paying attention to. Okay, so this is going to relate to the discussion we just had on all of our rampant conceptuality, okay? Because when that rampant conceptuality is going on, the mind, there's no introspective awareness, there's no mindfulness. And often what triggered all of that is something that we perceived with our senses. So we perceive an object with our senses, and then that starts this whole process of conceptualization about, I like it, I don't like it, and what does it mean to me, and what do they think of me, and blah, 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 blah. Okay? So then that brings up the whole topic, since all this, comes with what do we pay attention to with our five senses, to really this practice of binding our senses, which means taking care of, what we look at. And what we listen to, and what we're feeling, what we're smelling, what we're touching, what we're tasting, how much do we turn our attention to these objects and then get lost in conceptuality about them, okay? So, for example, if you go, into town to do an errand, but in the process of doing the errand, you start looking in all the windows of along the streets, yeah? Or you walk past the restaurant and you see the photos of the dishes that they have inside, then, you know, because you're not watching where you're putting your eyes, and your eyes are roaming the streets looking at all these other things, then it sparks a lot of non-virtuous thoughts, you know, a lot of craving, a lot of attachment, you know, maybe resentment because you can't have it or whatever, okay? Same thing with listening, you know. You go to the dentist office and our dentist plays all the 60s and 70s, you know, tunes that many of us know, and that, you know, you hear this song and it's like there you are back at the beach with your boyfriend when you were 16, okay? And, you know, by not realizing, you know, what are you paying attention to? Yeah. And of course, you know, you can't ask the dentist to turn off the music. So it may be coming in your ear, but there's many different ways you can pay attention, you know, you can really pay attention to that music and start singing along, you know, and then realize that you forgotten a few lyrics here and there, and then start going back over them because you want to remember the lyrics that you've forgotten. Yeah, have you done that with some of those songs? It's like, yeah, you get a certain bit of it, and then you've lost part of it. So then, you know, then your whole experience is turning to trying to remember what it was that you forgot, you know, the lyrics. So, you know, there's that way of listening to music and you get all, you know, lost in it. And then there's the way of just saying, okay, this is the old music, you know, it's coming in my ear, I can't be in the dental chair like this. you know, and these memories that are coming up, this, what an incredible meditation on impermanence, that here were all those things that I thought were so important that are gone. And look how easily my mind falls into daydreaming about them again, wishing to recreate them. Yeah? So instead of your 16-year-old boyfriend, well, now he's your 30-year-old boyfriend, or your 60-year-old boyfriend, or whatever it is, but that same mind of yearning, of, you know, feeling important to somebody else, you know, whatever it is, you know, you use that as an opportunity to see how diluted all of that is, yeah, and how easily we get lost in it, yeah. Some of you look skeptical. Yeah. But you use it as a meditation about, you know, the uselessness of falling in love. Yeah. Yeah. Isn't falling in love kind of useless? Yeah. Because the only thing to do after you fall in love is fall out of it. Like the only thing you do when you go up is to go down. You know, and the only thing that happens when you come together is to separate. Okay, so you know, you pay attention to it in a different way that helps you overcome your attachment. Okay, but basically the thing is to be really careful about what we look at and what we conceptualize about it, you know, because you may be looking, you know, walking down the street, and then your eyes go all over the place looking at all the people. And then pretty soon, it's like you see somebody, oh, that person's really good looking. And then conceptuality, blah, 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 blah. Okay? And, you know, lots of negativity in the process of it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? So you start, you know, sometimes you may see somebody, then your mind starts evaluating their body. Oh, I like how their shoulders look, but I don't like how their legs look, and I don't like this. But then this part of them looks good, and then what's arising in your mind?
Desire.
Yeah, desire, lust. Okay, so you can just look at, you know, notice that going on as you walk down the street. Or like, well, that person's actually not so good, let's find somebody better to look at, you know. Okay, but by not binding the senses, then we get lost. Yeah. Or, you know, again, just what do we listen to? What are we paying attention to when other people are talking? Yeah, when other people start talking about what somebody else is doing, do we kind of, you know, mosey up to the conversation to get all the latest gossip about what's going on, and then that starts a whole process of conceptualization. Why is that person doing this? Why aren't they doing that? I know what's best for them anyway. Blah, 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 blah. Okay? Or do we just kind of, you know, let it go and you know, not try and go and listen to it? So all these kinds of things, how, you know, not binding the senses really triggers a lot of affliction in our mind. Yeah? Is this your experience or not?
Yes.
What do you think?
I have a hard time with this. I struggle with this kind of between affections are running, and then just trying to feel like what it is, versus, and then when I try and like apply the antidotes, and then the mind is like fights it, and it's this last 1 month, what has been effective was just to self-empathy and just, you know, just watch it. Yeah, because antidotes just don't refuse to apply antidotes.
There's what?
Refusal to apply
antidotes, yes.
Yeah, it's just, yeah.
Yes.
And then, like, well, once I start to accept that, okay, it's crazy there, then sort of the mind sort of calm down.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not going away, but it's less violent.
Yes, it subdues. Yeah. The reason why we're often resistant to applying the antidotes is because we haven't really understood at a deep level the disadvantages of the afflictions. Yeah? We're still rather fascinated by what our mind creates, you know, and we're hooked into it, how we create angels and how we create demons. And so the mind says, well, why should I change? Yeah. Anyway, what I'm perceiving is real. Yeah. So you see how we, you know, what I'm perceiving is real. Applying an antidote is just whitewashing something that's real. Yeah. My anger is real and this person is doing something wrong. And that's real. And I should be angry. And why are you telling me to apply an antidote? I don't want to apply an antidote. Yeah? I want to tell this person how they need to correct themselves. Or, you know, gee, oh, that person's so good looking. Oh, that might be attachment. No, it's not attachment. It's warmth and connection for other living beings. On the Bodhisattva path, you have to feel care and concern for other living beings, and that's what I'm feeling, is care and concern, you know, because they're really very good looking, and I care about them, and I want them to be happy. And then why should I apply an antidote? I mean, that's stifling myself. Yeah. My natural goodwill towards others is arising. I don't want to stifle it. This is bodhisattva practice. After all, you know, if you can't love one person, how can you love all sentient beings? Yeah? You have to start with loving one person. I really like that one. You know, don't talk to me about antidotes. Okay? So, you know, why is that? It's because we haven't really seen the disadvantages of the afflictions. Yeah? And so if you want to, you know, understand the disadvantages, then you need to really go back to the Lam Rim and look at your own experience. Take out, you know, go back to the 57 faults and take out each one and look at your life. And when that particular one has been manifest and active, and what's happened? Is this something that benefits you? But if we don't do that meditation of really looking at how these mental states affect our life, if we don't do that meditation, then all this seems rather theoretical, and there's no real wish to abandon the afflictions.
Yeah. Many years ago, I would go walking with a friend, but we chose to walk in rich neighborhoods, and so we did everything but find the senses. So it was at night, we'd be looking in these very gorgeous homes, like the artwork inside. And we would do this for hours, and this was like fun. And then we'd get back home, and you know. So the end result was this huge craving for beautiful things that we were never going to have, and it eventually led to us scheming on how to rob a bank. That was the name of it.
Slowly things come out. Okay. So really watching how we use our senses is quite important. Yeah. So I gave examples with seeing and hearing, but applies also to smelling. You know, sometimes you smell a certain thing and it takes you way off to like last time you smelled that and what was going on, and either you hated it or you loved it, or, you know, and certain food, you know, have food reminds you of different things. You know, there might be a certain, you know, frozen bananas, you know, frozen chocolate covered bananas, yeah? That this reminds me when I was a kid and my family used to walk around Balboa Island, and this was a big treat to have frozen chocolate covered bananas. So, you know, I yeah, you too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then the mind goes off, oh, those days when I was a little kid with my mother and my father, and then, oh, my mother's life was like this, and this, and this, and this, and this. And my father's life was like that, and that, and that, and that. And then, you know, all this nostalgia, because, you know, I was 5 years old or 10 years old, and these sweet memories, but we all grow old, and they're dead now, and, you know, but I'm never gonna die. Yeah, but this reminds me of this picture. You know, when you look at, like, looking at old family pictures, yeah, do you get nostalgic? I remember that, and this, and the summer vacations, and you know? way off. Okay? So, and it's just a chocolate-covered banana. That's That's all. And for somebody else, you know, maybe chocolate-covered bananas have a really bad connotation because it's associated, you know, they were at the beach with their 16-year-old boyfriend and they had a fight while they were eating chocolate-covered bananas, so they don't want to see anything of it. So, yeah, okay. 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 Then Khenpo Rinpoche makes a comment here that that it's said, well, first of all, it's keeping good ethical conduct is often associated with incense and very sweet smells. And it's also associated with having a certain luster in your body. So, saying that people who keep really good ethical conduct have a certain vibe. Maybe they say a luster of their skin, but maybe what it just means is a certain vibe of somebody who keeps good ethical conduct that lets you know that you can trust that person. Yeah, and so he uses that as an example of ethical conduct that is form, but that's just another example of it, okay? But the real ethical conduct that's form is, the actions that you're doing motivated by virtue, by intention, the mental factor of intention that has another virtuous mental factor in that whole cognition. Okay, then fortitude is often, ethical conduct is of three types. Ethical conduct of abandoning non-virtue, of practicing virtue, and of benefiting sentient beings. Okay, so fortitude is also of three types. So abandoning anger, when others harm us, learning to tolerate suffering, physical suffering or mental suffering, and then bearing the difficulties of practicing the Dharma. So these all three are practices of fortitude that we have to do to make our minds strong, to avoid either collapsing into anger or just collapsing in general. Okay, and giving up. Okay, so this is called fortitude, so it's the ability to tolerate these things. But tolerate doesn't mean we sit there and, I'm going to bear this. I can't stand it. I'm furious about it. That's not practicing fortitude. Okay, it's really working with the mind so that we can accept the situation. So acceptance of situations is a key element to practicing fortitude. It's a key element to practicing a lot of things, okay? But especially with fortitude, because it might be, well, we're sick, and I don't want to be sick. I'm tired of being sick, But here I am, I'm sick. This has got to become my Dharma practice now. Or this person's criticizing me and this person's blaming me and I'm sick of having people do that and I'm ticked off at them and I don't like it. But, learning to just accept that, where am I going to go in this whole wide universe where nobody is going to criticize me? Think about that one for a while. Where are you going to go? Where nobody is going to criticize you. The only place is a Buddha land. So to do that, you have to become a Buddha. You can't buy a ticket, an air ticket to that place. So sometimes we just have to accept the situation. Yes, this person is mad at me. or this person's criticizing me, or, you know, they don't like me. And it's a free world. This is one of the things that the teens and early 20s, the young people in Singapore, when they were all asking me about what do I do because nobody likes me, you know. I was telling them about, you know, my rules of the universe, one of the major ones being everybody has to like me. And then to really sit and think, you know, it's a free world and people are entitled to their own free opinions. It's not up to me to dictate to them their opinions of me as much as I would like to. And some people may, for whatever reason, choose to think I'm obnoxious. And that's their right. And I don't have to get reactive about it. You know, I can accept that. Maybe. No, but you really try and get yourself to the point, well, yeah, I can accept that. Because, you know, like I said, where are you going to go where nobody's going to criticize?
We're looking.
Huh?
We're looking.
We're looking, yeah. And we go here and we go there and we go everywhere looking for the place where nobody's going to criticize us. And we can't find it. Because we're going to get criticized everywhere. And even if we found the perfect place, our internal critic is going to go to work. Yeah. And so who's worse, the internal critic or the external critic?
And that's a good sign that all karma hasn't yet carried itself off. That's a good sign. I mean, on the karma, of course, it carries with you, and you can be sure that wherever you're going, you will have it, that you will face it just because it's not finished.
If we've criticized others and we haven't purified that karma, you know, the karma follows us like a shadow follows a body, and of course, that's going to come. Okay. Then, joyous effort. Oh, okay. Yeah, so fortitude means having a relaxed mind that's calm. It doesn't mean, you know, like stuffing your anger down and gritting your teeth and, you know, okay, I'm patient now, but wait till I get my hands on that guy. No, it's not that. It's, you know, looking at the situation differently so that the anger just vanishes of its own accord. Because you've stopped the story behind the anger. Yeah, because the anger always has a story behind it. Yeah. With how somebody else is mistreating me. And sometimes people do mistreat us. But are we going to make that the story of our life? Okay, then joyous effort is taking delight in virtue. Okay, and so that makes us eager to practice and to fulfill the two collections. Meditative stability is one-pointed concentration that is free of afflictive thoughts such as laxity and excitement. Yeah. So laxity and excitement, both non-virtuous thoughts that impede our ability to focus in our meditation. And then wisdom is ascertaining the meaning of the four truths and the two truths. So that involves doing a lot of analysis and examination and investigation. And this wisdom is integrated with the aims of others because we want to use this wisdom to benefit others. And we, you know, when we have the idea of using it to benefit others, you know, then we have the bodhicitta motivation and we're integrating method and wisdom together in our practice. And then compassion, which is the last thing that we're told to practice here. So it's the mind that views all sentient beings equally and wishes them to be free of dukkha and the causes of dukkha. Okay? So compassion has a specific meaning here in Buddhism. Yeah. And especially here in the Bodhisattva practice. Because in general, compassion means wishing somebody to be free of whatever kind of dukkha or suffering they have and its causes. But in the Bodhisattva practice, it has to be based on viewing everybody equally and wanting everybody to be free of dukkha and its causes. There's some people now, there's a big discussion about empathy, and is empathy useful or not? Is it virtuous or not? And an example is given of, okay, you feel very empathetic with all the people in your own ethnic group, for example. Yeah, a lot of strong empathy for people in your own ethnic group. But very little empathy for people in a different ethnic group that have a different experience. Okay. Now what happens with that? If you have empathy for your people in your own group but not empathy for people in another group, what happens?
You create virtue on one side and negative karma on the other side.
Yeah. So you might create virtue on one side and negative karma on the other side.
Attachment and aversion.
Or your virtue might be based on attachment. In which case the virtue's greatly diminished because of the motivation. Okay. So it's quite important when we think of empathy, you know, that it's spread equally to everybody. It's not just focused on one group and not another group. Yeah. Because that can lead us to actions of love and compassion and altruism that are quite biased, that actually can bring about more upheaval and more pain. Yeah. If you have great empathy for people in your ethnic group and no empathy for people in another ethnic group, then that's describing a very important person in our country right now.
It's also how animals have empathy.
Yeah, it's just like animals, isn't it? And it has that same result of, you know, helping your friends, harming your enemies. And if you have power, then it becomes especially insidious. Okay? So we have to make sure when we're cultivating empathy that it's equal empathy for everybody. Yeah. And also this thing, you know how they talk about the scientists that we have mirror neurons, you know? And so when somebody else is experiencing something, the same part in our brain lights up as in their brain. And so they often say, well, this is empathy. But it's not really empathy. Because you could understand how somebody else is feeling and rejoice in their pain. Yeah? Somebody who's a sociopath might have that awareness of empathy and rejoice in it. Yeah? That's not virtuous. So these mirror genes, yeah, and the fact that they light up, yeah, when somebody in us, when somebody else is having a certain experience, doesn't always mean that it's a good kind of empathy. Because there's empathizing, understanding how somebody feels. That's one element. And then there's what you do with that understanding of how somebody else feels. Yeah. And do you create more bias and more obstacles or for that person? Or do you create more opportunities for them? Yeah, it's quite interesting when you really get into it and think about it and what happens.
Seems like that's why equanimity is so important.
Yeah.
That we start with that.
Yeah.
It seems like it's one of those fluctuating.
That's why it seems like it's so important to cultivate equanimity in the start of that, so that we level the playing field to begin with.
Yeah. Yeah, very much. Yeah.
I was curious, why is compassion coming at the back if it's a cause of bodhicitta?
It's interesting, why is compassion coming at the end of the six instead of at the beginning of the six? I don't know. Maybe it's talking about compassion, especially, and they mention it afterwards in terms of integrating it with all the previous ones. I don't know.
Isn't it that you need the you need joyous effort fortitude? And if you don't have joyous effort fortitude, I wonder how much your compassion will be of effect. Mm-hmm. For example, somebody does harm and you just flip out instead of understanding that this person does harm because this person is suffering. So you need this as a foundation to develop.
Okay. So you're kind of saying that on one hand, she was saying compassion is a cause of the bodhisattva practices. Yeah. But, and then you're saying, but it's also something that is affected when you do the bodhisattva practices. Because if you practice fortitude, if you practice joyous effort, then that strengthens your compassion. So, yeah, it's true. A lot of times people, things are put in a list for a certain reason, but then oftentimes, you know, everything, they, you know, they cross, they overlap. Yeah. Sometimes we tend to think of lists as in too rigid, yeah, or too linear of a fashion without realizing all the connections. Which is actually what the next paragraph is about. Okay, but we're going to save the next paragraph for next week. Okay, because that by the way, it'll be a little bit of a review for this week too. Okay, any other questions? Comments? Yeah.
So conceptuality has a pretty bad rap. I'm just wondering, how could you use it skillfully? Mentioned that asking it, is it realistic and is it benefiting others? But it seems like everything we do, we conceptualize first.
Yeah. Okay, so conceptuality can have many functions, and we need conceptual thought to practice the path at the beginning, because it's not like you sit down and instantly have direct perception of emptiness, or of anything for that matter. So, I mean, even listening to teachings right now, we're using language and conceptual thought, aren't we? and we're using it in a virtuous way, and it's important that we use language and conceptuality in this way. Yeah, when we talk about sometimes conceptuality and conceptualizations, then we're talking about how we spin out and what we also call proliferations. Yeah. So the idea is to be able to look, and as with anything that's a tool, how can it be used beneficially and how can it get lost in non-virtue, and really learn to see the difference between that, and in our own mind to be able to see, to determine and recognize what is a virtuous thought here and what is a non-virtuous thought. And when, you know, if we recognize those and we care about the results of our actions and the results of our thoughts, then that will help us cultivate the virtuous ones and apply the antidotes to, or simply let go of the non-virtuous ones. But yeah, conceptuality is needed on the path. I mean, just hearing teachings, studying teachings, and thinking about teachings, both of those definitely involve conceptions. Yeah. And even sitting down to meditate on them. You know, when we're doing long-term meditation, we're thinking about the topics. Okay. So in one way, I think studying the long-term, and especially when you start studying philosophy, it's teaching us how to think correctly. Because right now, we don't always know how to think correctly. And that's why we get lost in, you know, our mental escapades. But when we can learn, you know, how to think correctly, then we can bring ourselves back to a virtuous mental state. Okay, then we'll dedicate.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losam's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Idam Guram Namandalakam Niryatayami.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. And grow. May that form have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma,
done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West. Lord,